welcome. Today we have a special show with a person who came into native gaming in a very interesting way. An amazing person and a good friend. Please welcome Jim Webster. How are you, Jim?
Very good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on. Jim, we talked the other day, and let's get right down to it. You grew up in Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a pretty typical childhood. I had a good family. We lived in Neenah, Wisconsin, which was a little town of about 20,000, and they had a single high school. And it was a very comfortable childhood.
Now it was, you know, you were in the wilderness and rural areas doing, you know, hiking and hunting, all that stuff, right?
Well, we did more cross-country skiing on golf courses, and of course,
wow.
There was Lake Winnebago there. And we ended up playing a lot of sports at the local Y on the weekends and stuff, and then at the high schools for after school, both on the organized teams and intramurals. So it was I did not do as much hunting as fishing as some of my friends did, but it was definitely that type of terrain.
Yeah. And you, at the beginning of, you know, growing up, you didn't really know you were native, right? That came later. What happened? How did that happen?
Oh, it's brief of it is that my mother, who's Indian, grew up very poorly, I should say, and she grew up in Wisconsin, experienced a lot of prejudice, and really was she felt a lot of hurt growing up, and she wanted to spare her kids from that same prejudice. So she just decided that she wasn't going to make that a focal point of our childhood. And we actually, my sister and I, who's 2 years older, did not learn until we were in our early teens that we were Native American. And that was when my grandmother stopped by to register us for the tribe, to put us on the rolls.
What did you think about that? What were your feelings when you found out about that?
I thought it was kind of cool.
it is.
It was, I did not experience any prejudice against minorities, although it was primarily a white community that I grew up in. There wasn't a lot of negative consequences associated with that. My friends accepted it and, you know, teased me, but in a friendly, teasing way about it. Nothing was malicious. So it worked out well for me. And
sounds great.
Yeah, actually, we were signed up for the Ho-Chunk Nation. It was called the Winnebagoes at the time, primarily because there was going to be a land settlement. My grandmother knew about this, so she wanted to get us on the rolls. And my freshman year in college, the settlement came through. I think it was $1,200, but it actually funded me for the summer to go hitchhiking through Europe. So it was,
wow,
I had,
that's amazing.
Yeah, I had great memories and benefits from being Native American. So
that's amazing. That's incredible. Where did you end up going? Through your
flew into Luxembourg, went to Germany. We had an AFS student in our high school, so we stopped by and saw her. Then I split up, and it was right after the Roots series. So my grandfather is Scottish, never naturalized. So I went over, hitchhiked over, crossed the channel, went up into Scotland, into Edinburgh and Glasgow, came back down, stayed in London, hitchhiked down through Paris to Italy, down the coast of Italy to Pompeii, and then up along Nice, and then up through Spain and back to Luxembourg and came home. It was a great adventure.
Wow, that's amazing. How old were you, Jim, when you did that?
19.
Amazing. How do you think that affected the rest of your life, that trip?
It was eye-opening. I think travel is one of the best educations you can get. It exposes you to so much and so many people. I think it's invaluable to get out and travel. And whether it's with friends and family or whether it's on your own, I think you take away things that would not be available to you character building wise otherwise.
Yeah, I agree. I've done some pretty extensive traveling, and I lived in some of those countries. I lived in Italy for 3 years and went to elementary school there. So those
very
parts
cool.
of my life really shaped, yeah, it's very shaped who I was. So I completely see how that affected you, because it was the same for me. Those trips affected me fundamentally for the rest of my life, and I would suggest it to anybody. You know, Jim, I mean, traveling is amazing.
Yeah.
It really is. So what happened? What were some of your first jobs? I know you have a very unusual story, because of the fact that you started in the corporate world, right? And you really weren't brought up on the res. So here you are, you know, traveling to Europe, having a good upbringing, not having any of the prejudice, and then where does your first job come from, and what happens then?
Well, actually, after college and I graduated from the University of Wisconsin, I moved out to Connecticut and was working odd jobs out there, really looking for that first in an opportunity. And my mother at the time was living in Chicago, and she was riding the train into work. She was working on Michigan Ave, but she was talking to this person who had started with a company called Altel, and that was one of the first telephone service resellers in the nation. Back in the 80s, Judge Green broke up AT&T and opened up telecommunications to private industry. And this was one of the first companies that took advantage of that opportunity and actually grew to be the third largest carrier in the nation. So from there,
wow.
I was started on the ground floor. I was ordering and installing RJ21 jacks for dialers, and nobody's going to know what that is, but it was grunt work. But I made a number of friends that really exposed me to the technology side of network switching within telecommunications. And from there, I got a job as a traffic engineer and then a network planner. And from there, I moved into software development and sales, and then system integration. And eventually made it to product development and product marketing. And that is really what gave me a technological and product management background that really helped immensely when I came into the Native American industry.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Tell me, Jim, you know, you were able to climb up the ladder in so many different areas. What are some of the qualities that you learned, that you took away from during that period that helped you throughout your career?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that the most valuable quality that, and actually my parents drilled this into me, was hard work and long hours and paying your dues. And I know, you know, that doesn't sound real attractive, but that's exactly what it was. It was putting in the 110% at each job that gave me an up and an ability, and I believe people recognized that drive and gave me opportunities that I wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. Of course, education helped also.
Yeah, you have to have the drive, don't you? You really have to have the drive, and you really got to want it.
Right. So, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so I think, the work ethic is definitely a very important contributing factor, but I think the drive to improve yourself and to put in the time necessary to learn what you're doing inside and out is also very important. It's you almost want to become an expert at each job that you have, whether it's insignificant or whether, it's managing, part of an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So here you are, do all these things, these great things, and you're learning all this technology, and you're native and the whole thing. So what happened? How did you get into working with the tribe? How did that transition happen?
Well, my mother, in her later years, and this is now, I didn't go back. I was never raised on the res. I wasn't really exposed to the Indian culture. So in my 40s, my mother decided that she wanted to give back to the Ho-Chunk Nation. So she ran for the legislature and was elected. She got to know another legislator who became president of the nation. And then the nation passed a law saying all executive directors had to have a college education, and I was in the right place at the right time. There weren't a lot of Ho-Chunk with college educations. So they brought me in as treasurer of the nation.
When you say they brought you in, did someone just like call you out of the blue? I mean, how does that happen?
Yes, that's exactly how it happened.
So paint the picture for us. Where were you? You were still at another job? Where were you, at home, and you get the call? Paint the picture for us.
Yeah, well, the picture is, and it's not that pretty. I was, again, at the right place at the right time. The technology market had just crashed. And so I had started up a energy company in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was working with a friend to build that up, and we were starting to make a go of it. But then I got this call saying, hey, they want you to be treasurer of the nation, and it's an appointed position by the president. From my mother. From my mother. And then
great.
She said, call this guy. So I called George Lewis, who was an excellent guy, and he brought me in. I had some immediate successes in the Treasury Department, and that was based on my business experience and education. And then they moved me over to Executive Director of Business, so I was in charge of all the casinos and C-stores and manufacturing.
So let me ask you, here you are coming from years and years and years in the corporate world, and now all of a sudden you're in the native business, environment. What were the major differences, and what were some of the things that you had to adjust with how you dealt with things and
master them
to continue moving forward?
I'll tell you that. It was a eye-opener because in the corporate world, it's pretty straightforward as to who your boss is, how decisions are made, how you get things done. But coming into a tribal environment, it's very political, and it turned me upside down as far as how do I get stuff done. And they definitely appreciated my straightforward business approach to things, but if you wanted to get things done, it was more political. And then there was the cultural side to it. Since I had not been exposed to it, I didn't know any of the traditions associated with the Ho-Chunk Nation, the Ho-Chunk tribe, and I didn't have the cultural background, just for common courtesies. Fortunately, my parents raised me to be very respectful of people in general, and that is a key component of the Ho-Chunk Nation culture and tradition, and that helped me immensely, just by luck. By being respectful, I began to fit in.
Yeah, because a lot of it has to do with the cultural customs and how their philosophy is on everything, not just business, right?
Correct. Definitely.
On life and itself.
Yeah, exactly. And then the political aspect of it's really was difficult to comprehend on how family relationships and the loyalty that exists within families could override, you know, straightforward business decisions and stuff. But it does. And
why do you think that is and how can it be corrected?
I don't think it needs to be corrected. I think that is the way that most Native American tribes are. I think that what it does is it makes us compromise in the way that we get things done and for what our final results might be. And it may not be as optimal as we had hoped for, but it still moves the tribe in the right direction. So,
interesting. That's very interesting. I like that. What do you think that, you said to me once that I remember talking to you and you were saying that there's a way of dealing with people in the tribe, the elders and the new generation coming up. Explain that a little bit to me.
Right. And let me just put this in context for the listeners. And
yeah.
That is that in the tribe, we have the people that started the tribe, that actually filed with the BIA to have their tribes federally recognized so that there were economic and gaming opportunities available. And these guys typically were raised on the res, were raised culturally based on what their tribe's culture was, and they had to acclimate to the white world in order to get some of the things that they needed. And they worked very hard to do that, but they retained their cultural integrity. And what that has done is it's allowed the next generations to go off and become educated in the European culture. And they're starting to come back to the tribes now. So that's really the difference between the elder generation that is still running the tribe and actively involved in it, and the younger people that are starting to come back with educations, and really wanting to retain the cultural and traditional aspects of their tribe. They don't want to let those things go. They see the importance to their people that they have. They just have vastly different approaches to doing it nowadays. So to answer your question, the elders in the tribe deserve a great deal of respect, not only for the hard work that they put in and their accomplishments, but traditionally just for their knowledge. They are put in very high esteem as far as the hierarchy goes. I think it's veterans first and then elders, and then then it's tribal people, and then it's kids, as far as the hierarchy goes. So, whereas this newer generation of tribal members who have gained a education are really coming back wanting with some of the business principles that they've learned and trying to implement those while still trying to retain the cultural aspect of it. So it's where a elder needs to be treated with a great deal of respect and you speak when spoken to, that type of thing. This younger generation, you need to implore some logic, business logic, to convince them and still maintain a respectful conversation with them. They deserve respect also in what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, yeah. I've never really heard it put that way, but it's a little different from with the young generation and as opposed to the elders, right?
Yes. Very different.
Yeah,
they have the same issues that somebody coming in not exposed to it before have also. You know, they want to move quickly. They want to, you know, they want to entertain risk. And elders are much more conservative than that and patient.
Yeah. Right.
So
yeah,
it's interesting.
A good quality to have. What do you think are the most important things the tribe should be doing to ensure the survival of all their businesses, not just gaming for the years to come?
I really think that as gaming comes, as the markets become saturated with gaming, and we're almost to that point now, that the tribes really need to enhance the experience that they're providing to their customers. And I think I would like to see them do that by incorporating some of the better values of their traditions and culture into their customer service. I would like them to share some of the history of their tribe with the non-natives that are coming as customers to their facilities. And I think there's a pent-up demand to learn about the Native Americans now that we didn't have 30 years ago. And I don't think it's being fulfilled by any of the tribes well right now. Maybe a few, but in general, it's not being addressed as well as it could. And I think that will be the bastion of lore that people will always seek out in the future. Or maybe I should say that's the next phase, and maybe it'll evolve to something beyond that. But I really think if they can share some of their knowledge and their ways with the customers and guests that are patronizing them, that will enhance the experience and build loyalty with their customers.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very important thing, that human touch, right?
Yes.
That human touch. A lot of people listening will be wondering, you know, how do you become a GM? What is the path? Where do you start? What is your advice to them?
I would really say that it is more of a team building and leadership position, that it's not necessarily a set of skills that you bring to the position, but that it's that you work well with people, that you can build and promote teamwork within a facility, that you can provide a vision along with a roadmap on how to achieve that vision, and accountability. You still need to hold yourself accountable, as a fiduciary for the tribe, and you need to hold your direct reports accountable for their actions and responsibilities.
Yeah, very important. What's the key to making a casino successful?
It is customer service. We deliver a service. We don't necessarily deliver a product other than our restaurant. So it's really the experience that we can provide, and that is 95% of it's delivered by humans, so by the employee. So it's really gaining control of the customer service standards that are adhered to within the casino. That along with marketing, of course.
yeah, of course. Yeah, customer service is the number one thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. It is. Most Native American casinos have a very solid local market, and it's really driven by proximity to the casino. You're going to go to where it's easiest to get to gaming experience. But it's how you're treated once you get there, and it's whether you feel value and whether, you know, you feel as though you're part of that organization's family, extended family. That is really what drives a successful casino.
Yeah, extended family. That's a good way of putting it. When you look back at everything that you've done in your entire life, what do you think you're the most proud of?
I would have to say my family and friends, who they are. I really feel like I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world. Just because I have such a good core group, support group. I could be anywhere doing anything, and with this family and friends, you know, I'd feel like $1 million.
Yeah, they're pretty well everything. And, yeah, I feel the same way about my family. Yeah, the family is the most important thing, isn't it?
Yes.
The most important thing. All right, let's take some calls.
All right.
See what we got. What we got over here. Let's see. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Mr. Webster? Hello.
Hi. Hey. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yeah, we can hear you good. This is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Jim?
Yeah, sure thing. Mike out of Las Vegas. Really enjoy your program. Good show.
Thank you.
Question. Looking at, obviously, a lot of press lately about sports betting, something near and dear to my heart. How is the, you know, as a tribal property and tribal community, how are you guys ramping up for sports betting? Are you ramping up to start taking sports bet? What is the outlook? And what do you think from an overall tribal perspective, what do you think that we'll see in the future in that area?
Good question. It's a good question with a complicated answer in the sense that we really need to change our compact in order to offer the sports betting. Because our compact defines what is allowable at all the casinos. We have 11 tribes and 26 different casinos in Wisconsin. So I think that all the tribes are looking at opening up their compacts, but there is some risk associated with that because most of us had tried for perpetuity but gotten 25-year compacts, which is good. It gives us enough time to transfer from one generation to the next as far as management goes and planning. But there's a possibility that if we open up the compacts to add sports betting, that the state could come back and either up our compact fees and or play with the duration of the compact. So that's something that we're dealing with right now.
Interesting.
And that is a decision that's over my head right now. I will say that we're ready to take sports betting on. However, it would be very much like off-track betting, where you would have two or three large organizations that actually put the back office system together, and then we would just resell that at our facility. Although it would enhance the image of the casino and the experiences for our customers, so there's no doubt that we would do it. It just wouldn't, I don't see it as a huge moneymaker for the casinos.
Yeah, have your customers and players been, you know, since the news has broke with the Supreme Court ruling, have they been asking for you the question? Is there interest from your players that you're hearing?
There is interest, but it's more conversational interest. It's there is nobody beating on the door saying when are you going to get it? When are you going to get it? It is. Are you going to get it? And, you know, how are you going to get it? And when are you going to get it? So, but I don't feel a urgency about it. I think that the tribe is approaching it very cautiously because of the risks associated with opening up the compact. And but they are actively pursuing it. It's on our list of things to do. And if the opportunity works out, we will definitely open it up to sports betting.
That's great. Well, thanks a lot, and I appreciate you guys taking my call.
Oh,
thank
welcome.
You so much. Have a great night.
You too.
All right. That was good. Good question. Let's see what we got here. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta.
Hello.
I have Jim Webster here. Do you have a question for him?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello, can you hear me? Yes, Jim,
yes,
this is Joe. How are you doing?
Joe. What kind of a question do you have, Joe?
So Jen, I have a lot of respect and for your knowledge of marketing. I mean, we've had a number of conversations, and I'm always very impressed with how you approach it. Generally speaking, general managers come from the finance realm, the operations realm, but I know you have a deep marketing background. My question to you is, overall, what is the how do you rate the importance of casino marketing in the overall scheme of things in a casino environment?
I personally can. Would rank it my number one priority. In fact, I had my marketing director in here right before the show, and I was explaining to her that we would move funds from other operational departments to marketing to address the changes we're experiencing in our marketplace today. So definitely, if you are not communicating and if you are not communicating through the media and through the providing the right message to your customers, your doors, your slot machines are going to be empty.
Yeah. Also, why do you think also, Jim, that, you know, generally speaking, I mean, you know, a VP of marketing is not the next choice for the GM or the CEO. Why does it always have to come from finance and operations? And is it just because the role of the marketer is not fully appreciated, or why do you think that is?
You know, I would say that the marketing is basically thought of as kind of a soft art. And that you need more analytical skills to be in the general manager position. fortunately, my background started out with those analytical skills, and I gained the marketing afterwards, and I have a great appreciation for both. Operationally,
yeah,
you definitely need to be able to crunch the numbers and recognize where the red flags are. And marketing-wise, you need to drive the services and the image to your customers that's going to bring them through the doors.
And my last quick question, Jim, you mentioned analytics. How important do you think are analytics to your whole marketing approach, your marketing, your messaging, your, you know, analyzing the results of your programs? How important do you think that is to a casino?
It's hugely important. In fact, marketing is nothing without market research, and whether that is the demographics, psychographics, or the analytics of what your own system can tell you, you cannot deliver a message to the right people unless you do that market research. So, you have to have the analytics behind the marketing decisions in order to be successful.
All right. Thank you.
Great.
Thank
you, Joseph. Thanks for calling in.
You bet.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, that was good. Joseph's a good guy. Some good questions so far. Let's see who else we got
here.
Yeah,
yeah, they are. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Hello, this is GC Radio. You have a question for Jim?
Good evening, guys. How you doing?
Good evening. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Jim, what city are you in right now?
I'm in Nakusa, Wisconsin.
Natusa, Wisconsin. Okay.
Nakusa. Nekossa.
Yes, okay. I know. I've driven through it once, I'm sure. I'm sitting in Sheboygan, so
okay,
we're a ways apart, but, you know, you guys have a major stronghold in this marketplace, and it's incredible. And my first question is, I have a lifetime involvement in the entertainment industry, and which is a parallel to you and pretty wide statement. Mine was in the music business. And I found in the 70s, when I was a young guy thinking I could set the world on fire, as it got years and decades along, say the last 20 years, it became different for me, and I'm asking this in a parallel question, to the seniors in the tribe. It became difficult to me to always understand what the young people who now had gotten an education, because there was one now in the music business, because colleges had programs, and all of a sudden they come to me, they get a job, they learn how to dial phones, make calls, do stuff, and then now it's an internet business. But did the seniors find it a challenge when they were encountered with this fresh look from the young guys that did come out of college?
From my perspective, I would say they found it as an opportunity to impart some wisdom on these young upstarts that were coming back. So, I don't think they were offended by it. You know, they may have been taken aback by a bit, but I think they saw it as to, this is great that you have this knowledge. This is where we need to be, and we're proud of you for going out and gaining that knowledge, but this is how we treat each other in the tribe, and this is how we treat our guests, and this is how you can best use your knowledge. So the elders of the tribe really do impart wisdom on the other tribal members, and that's part of the reason that they're held in such high esteem.
Fabulous. It's I've also been extremely impressed with your philosophies of what's important, family and friends, because you do get to choose friends and you do get to choose family in one form until the kids come along, and then they choose you and you have to walk the march to keep them happy. But I think, again, being a Wisconsin guy, as you explain it, normally I explain it as a Vince Lombardi philosophy. He didn't step on the field and throw the football. He stood on the side and he made things go the right way. And everybody won when he did. And I look at what you're talking about and feel that you touched that a lot. And I think you touched me deeply with your comments about your beliefs, the tribal beliefs, and the history of the tribe. Someday I'm going to show up over there and I'm going to take you to coffee. And
I would enjoy that. Thank you.
Okay, don't be surprised. I do this kind of stuff, and especially when I hear somebody that I go, now this is a guy I want to meet, and you definitely are one of those. I commend you on what you're doing. You're steering a pretty darn big ship in a ever-changing industry, but you appear to have a good handle on it and a good long-range view. It is kind of interesting, as you said, about operations and marketing, because seldom do those two people sit at the same table or in the same chair.
So yeah, I agree.
Is your family like that? Is there experience, communications, marketing, social background in your family?
No, my dad was a salesperson, so communications. Mm-hmm. But he had an economics degree from Madison, and my mom was a registered nurse. But she went on to develop businesses in the corporate world too, for home health care and stuff. So she had a lot of drive.
It's great hearing you tonight. The show's great. I'm knocked out, and I look forward to meeting with you soon and continued success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for calling in. Have a great night. Great stuff.
Very nice.
Yeah, we get some really great callers calling in, people that appreciate the show. Hello, this is Tina Magnetta. I have Jim Webster on the line. Do you have a question for him? Hello. I guess there's nobody there. Okay, we'll come back to that one. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. I have Jim Webster. Do you have a question for him?
Excuse me. Great show, guys. Jim, I have a quick question for you. Who would you say was a mentor to you, and how did it change and inform your career?
I would say that I had a number of mentors at different phases in my life. So part of my core values were really instilled by my football coach, Gary Parker. But moving on in life, I would say that Bob Wright, who was a manager of mine when I was working at MCI, very family-oriented guy, very smart, but balanced things extremely well between work and family, and then brought a great deal of integrity into the job in the workplace, along with understanding. So he was one of the first great team builders that I had run across. And then I would say that President George Lewis of the Ho-Chunk Nation was another great mentor of mine, and shared a great deal of wisdom, gave me a great deal of guidance, and that combined together really gave me an empathy for the people that I'm working with and the teamwork that I try to facilitate, and the way that I hopefully treat my friends and family on a day-to-day basis also. Does that answer your question?
It does, thanks.
Yep.
Are you there? Hello?
I'm still here.
Jim?
Yes.
Oh, we dropped out for a second. I was saying, did you laugh when you mentioned your football coach? You laughed. Was there was there a reason for that? Was he a real character?
Yeah, he was. He was kind of a hard nose, but had a heart of gold. So.
Yeah, I can tell by the way you reacted to that. Okay. Okay, let's see here. Let's see what else we have here. So, some pretty neat stuff that you're talking about.
Okay.
Really neat stuff. Yeah. Let's see what else we got here. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Jim?
Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we can.
Hey, what do you think are the biggest challenges that Gamey is going to be faced in the next couple of years?
Seriously, I would say that it would be the baby boomers' transition into, you know, their parents' role. You know, my target audience is like 50 to 70. And I'm in a rural area in Wisconsin, but it's an older crowd that really enjoys the experience of coming to the casino, and it's not just for gaming. It's more of a social experience for them. I'm not sure if the baby boomers and the millennials after that have that same value. I'm not necessarily seeing it. So it's really, you know, what's going to happen once this current customer base ages out of, you know, wanting to come to the casino and experience it. That would be my number one challenge, where the next customers are coming from. And then it will be the evolution of the internet and social gaming and what that really means for Native American tribes, whether it just it opens it up to everybody, commercial and Native Americans, and takes the exclusivity away from the Native American tribes, you know, or where exactly that's going. And I don't think it's well defined in the industry right now.
Interesting.
So, yeah,
very
those
good.
Would be the two major issues I would see.
Do you see any of the kids come in with their parents? You know, the parents that are in the 50-plus demo, like a family night type of thing, even though the kids are a bit, you know, into their adult.
Yeah, it's, you know, there are, each casino has to address the market that they have. So, and I've managed a number of the Ho-Chunk casinos. So I've managed the Wisconsin Dells one, and the customers there are more metropolitan, so that you could bring them to the casino, and then we had like a kids quest, and you drop the kids off in the kids quest. They could be entertained with movies and games and that type of stuff while the parents enjoyed some of the gaming. In the casino that I'm at now, it's much more of a rural area, and it's there is no place for the kids to go. So it's like the adults have to come on their own. Did that answer your question, though?
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in.
Sure.
Great stuff. Okay. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a call for Jim Webster?
Hi, I do. I've really been – can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Cool. I have been really enjoying the program, and I have to tell you, in the beginning when you were talking about the way that you were raised and the work ethic and the respect for authority and for elders, I don't think that that can be underestimated in terms of, developing sound citizens and sound sound potential business folks and workers. And I have so much respect for that. And I was lucky enough to be in that kind of a situation growing up. I don't know how lucky I felt at the time, but, it certainly helped out a lot. My question really, though, is more around technology and listening to your career path and understanding that you were, in high-tech world for many years and seeing how although it might be lagging behind a bit, technology is more and more important, plays a more and more important role in casino. And, we look at the way that we have systematic delivery of or ordering of cocktails and promotions that are on kiosks and, customer service that's being delivered through basically primitive forms of artificial intelligence. Do you see that as a plus? Where do you see that going? How do you think that factors in, like self-comping, et cetera? How does that factor in with these ideals that we have of good guest service as the differentiator?
It is. I mean, it's part of the casino model. And the way I envision it is that you have a automated portion to your customer service, and that's with the kiosks and with the media manager, the service window on the computer where you can order your drinks and, a server will eventually bring it to you and that type of stuff. And then you have where you really start to personalize the experiences at the rewards club desk, but those are very short interactions, and you need to develop a program where your agents are delivering an appropriate message for the short duration of the engagement. And then you have your casino hosts, your executive casino hosts that really handle the top 13% of the customers that are the big spenders there. So, but to answer your technology question, I agree with you. They're very primitive attempts at automating customer service right now, and they have there is a lot of opportunity for growth and improvement in those systems, and they don't do nearly what we would like them to do, and they're not nearly as intelligent as they could be.
I appreciate that. I've got a question to follow up on that. What would be the most, if there was a particular function that you think is missing in terms of the technological delivery of service in casinos, is there anything that sticks in your mind as something like, gosh, why don't we do that?
I would say the personalized marketing at the slot machine is really missing. There have been a few attempts by vendors, and service window is, I don't think it's unique to IGT, but the ability to automate value add to the customer's experience based on their behavior is what I think is missing. That if somebody has been at the slot machine for 4 hours and just pounding away, it might be nice to open up the service window and say, if you would like us to reserve this machine for you while you get something to eat or use the restroom or whatever, press this button. and then it would lock it up for them until they come back to that machine. But you know, it's that type of thing that should be possible, but hasn't been delivered to the marketplace yet.
Interesting. You know, I mentioned a drink on demand, and then I think you mentioned it as well. And I've always been skeptical of that because I think at the end of the, I mean, yes, you certainly might be able to get your order in faster, but I think there is a implied promise that you're going to get your drink faster. And I don't think that's the case, certainly not the case all the time. And I think you such in that particular instance, I think you set yourself up for disappointing your guests as opposed to improving them.
Yeah,
anyway,
I mean,
that's my thought.
You know, as you have more orders coming in, you need more servers. And if you don't recognize that operationally, you definitely set yourself and your customer up for a bad experience.
I think so. I'm in the industry. I'm doing a job right now in Las Vegas, and I'm staying at a property that has legendary service. And I'm not sure to what extent they rely on technology to assist, but I don't think there's, at least to my way of thinking, any substitute for the one-on-one positive personal communication, the friendly delivery of service. And it seems like you share that ideal from listening to you speak.
I definitely do. I have security guards that will tap a customer on the shoulder and say, "Do you want me to save this machine for you while you run and do something?" And I have customers that grab a security officer and say, "Save this for me, would you?" And they do. And that's part of the relationship that they've built, and that's part of the customer service that this facility delivers.
How do you build that culture?
You know, it was here when I got here. It's a small community, and I'm a major employer in the community. But these people that work here, that have been able to raise families by working here, live with the people that are customers here, live in the same neighborhood. So they know them on a personal level. It's incredible.
Yeah,
it would not be
that
way. Yeah, in Wisconsin Dells, where it's more of a touristy market, you can't always have that. So it's not like this is you could take the solution here and rubber stamp it everywhere. You really have to deal with the market that you're in.
Yeah.
I just want to make another comment about what you said earlier regarding
no problem.
Personalization based on behavior. I have a colleague that was working with me on a job, and he was in his situation. He was 1,000 miles away from home, and he had a quick loss on a blackjack table of about $400 or $500. I don't remember because there might have been bourbon involved, but through what I'll call sloppy database marketing. You know, because the time on the game, you know, the number of hands, you know, didn't factor, and apparently they didn't look at actual. They sent him a $5 coupon from 1,000 miles away, and I think that's worse than doing nothing.
Yeah, that's where analytics and analysis come in before you do your direct mail.
And I don't know that an algorithm can replace a human just yet when it comes to making those kinds of decisions, but we get smarter every day, I guess.
That's funny.
That's amazing.
All right, well,
I enjoyed speaking.
Really
appreciate
you so much.
Your time.
Thank you. Take care, guys. You bet.
Have a good night. Bye-bye. Bye. All right. Well, Jim, it's been a fantastic show. So much interesting insights and stories, and you just bring a unique angle to the whole thing. It was a pleasure having you on, and we definitely want you back on the show sometime. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Have a great night.
No problem. Same to you. Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Well, that was bye-bye. That was great. Jim is, as you've heard, he definitely has a different slant on everything, and a well-rounded journey. So next week, is it Wednesday? Next Wednesday, we have a special show October 1st, which is the one-year anniversary of the Las Vegas shooting, which, of course, spurned the Vegas Strong movement and made the city of Las Vegas come together in a way that had never come together before. And we have Brian DeCora, who was there at MGM. He was in the city. And he's going to tell you his harrowing story about what happened at MGM during the shooting and how that inspired him to take action and actually bring some people in to recreate a live shooting in his casino to train his people. So it's going to be a fantastic show on a lot of levels, and please tune in. Remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen to it. You all have a great evening. Take care. Bye.